Hello and welcome to the BitBlock Boom Podcast. I'm your host, Gary Leland, producer of the BitBlock Boom Bitcoin Conference. And just for reference, I also produce the 4-Minute Bitcoin Podcast, available everywhere podcasts are available. Now, every August, I host the BitBlock Boom Bitcoin Conference in Dallas, Texas, with the help of many of my friends. If you are interested in Bitcoin, you really need to visit bitblockboom.com and take a look at the great speaker lineup and all the events that are going on around BitBlock Boom. You see, BitBlock Boom is a true Bitcoin conference, and I really mean a true Bitcoin conference. Now, in this episode, I'm featuring a session from the 2020 BitBlock Boom Conference by Guy Swan. Let's take a listen. BitBlock Boom!
He put the mic on. Yay! All right. So I'm Guy Swan. The guy's read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. That might be a tall order in this room, but I think I could get away with it. I host the Bitcoin Audible podcast. Many of you may know about it, where I read Bitcoin. So I got proof of work, about, you know, some thousand odd hours into that one. My talk is about Bitcoin being an unstoppable force. Herman Francis Mark was a chemist. He was famous for discovering kind of like an X-ray diffraction technique that figured out a new way to look at and discover like the structure of polymers and proteins and stuff. A pretty big deal. And in the 1930s, he lived in Austria when the Nazis were coming to power. He was also the son of a Jewish father. When the Nazis began to consolidate power, he and his wife went to the black market. He saw the writing on the wall. And he and his wife started to buy on the black market secretly platinum wire. And let's try this one more time. Leave it up on the thing. Just walk around like this. Okay. So, where was that? What was it? Platinum wire. They twisted it into coat hangers. They spent $50,000 worth. He put literally their entire last life savings into platinum wire. By the way, $50,000 then is about $900,000 today. And he twisted it into coat hangers, and his wife made these like little cloth covers so they just look like any old cheap, worthless hangers. Now, he actually got arrested when the political union of Germany and Austria was announced. And they revoked his passport, but he was actually lucky enough to get out in like pretty short order, just under the strict order that he could not contact anybody of Jewish descent. And so they put a Nazi flag on the, first he had to actually bribe, he had to take a whole year's worth of salary and bribe a corrupt official to get his passport back. And then he put the Nazi flag on the radiator of his car. He put a ski rack on top, and they put a whole bunch of ski equipment, and they got their whole family together, and they drove to the border with a trunk full of their clothes on what looked like worthless hangers. And, you know, they did a general search, but here's just a family leaving the country and, you know, going skiing. And they left everything behind. They left their house, their friends, they didn't tell anybody, and they never went back. But they took their life savings with them, disguised as a bunch of worthless coat hangers. Bitcoin is the first thing to ever turn value into pure information. And I don't think, you know, people talk all the time about like, it's like, oh, you can put 24 words in your head and you can leave the country and like nobody can catch you. And like we talk about that all the time, but I really don't think we stress how meaningful that actually is. Like that is a profound shift in the history of humanity. And One of the things that like the element, you take Mark's story, and one of the things about it is that if he actually shared that with anyone else, it wouldn't work anymore, right? Like, as soon as he told somebody else, it's like, dude, make your coat hangers in the platinum wire. Well, then it falls apart. Like, the next guy gets caught, and suddenly it's worthless because he shared it with other people. Bitcoin's the exact opposite. If I share it and tell everybody about it, it becomes more accessible and it becomes more powerful for the exact use case. It doesn't take away its power, it doubles it. Like, so we can share it with everyone and actually give everyone this level of sovereignty and power, and a huge shift in the dynamic between the power of the individual to protect their own wealth versus the power of the state to take it from them. And that's just not something that, you know, that's not something that comes along every now and then. So Bitcoin, we've reached a point where I think the cat is out of the bag, so to speak. You know, Pandora's box is open. The toothpaste is out of the tube. We're not gonna get it back in there. And I don't think there's a lot of the skepticism or criticism that, you know, maybe Bitcoin would be banned. And obviously, you know, the general skeptic or whatever, there's a whole slew of kind of the general arguments against Bitcoin that, you know, it doesn't work as money, that it's too volatile, it's too slow, all those things, all the general ones. In fact, Parker Lewis, you know, is going to have a speech gradually, then suddenly he has an awesome, just a phenomenal series that basically hits all of these one by one. But he hits one in that series called Bitcoin Cannot Be Banned. And one really interesting realization that he has in that is that the shift from and Bitcoin cannot be banned is kind of that next stage. So like after you get through like Bitcoin can't work as money, that's like kind of that next like automatic response. It's like, oh, well, governments will just ban it. But in that assumption is actually, it's not just that they conceded the first point. It's that they're holding, the presumption is the polar opposite of that first assumption. It's not that Bitcoin can now, okay, maybe it can work as money. It's literally that it could work so well as money that Bitcoins would have to ban it. And like, so in that, they're literally, you've already won. Like the argument's already over. We've basically agreed that Bitcoin works as money. But there are a handful of elements that just make Bitcoin truly unstoppable, that puts us in that position of the cat is out of the bag. The network is completely distributed. It's on hundreds of thousands of computers all across the globe. There's no actual jurisdiction of Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a new jurisdiction competing with the global financial system. It's by far the most secure computational network in the world. And I actually think a lot of people complain about like, it's like, oh, ASICs are terrible for centralization. I actually think ASICs are the best thing that ever happened to Bitcoin security. And I'll get into that a little bit in a minute. But the combination of like the hash rate distribution, the fact that, you know, a lot of people point out that like, oh, all the pools are in China or whatever. But if you look at, there's a great piece by Stop and Decrypt that shows the breakdown. Slush Pool has actually publicly posted their breakdown of how distributed their hash power is. Like these are pools. These are just people logging into a website and mining together in one location. It's not that they have control over all of this hash power. This is thousands and thousands of miners, a lot of people in this room probably, who are working together into one place to pool their hash power. And we've also moved through a couple of eras in Bitcoin mining, and the one that we're moving into, I think, is going to actually have another profound shift toward the decentralization of mining. Is as it becomes married to the energy production sector, and then also as political instability actually forces the increased mobility of mining hardware, and we're actually seeing this with like upstream data and the ability to like put these, install these things in like no time at all in these like, containers or whatever that they can just ship around, like in a matter of days, moving tons and tons of hashing power, setting it up like you're setting up somebody's cable subscription. And then also on the mining note is that a 51% attack is not really the death sentence that a lot of people make it out to be. I'll get there in a second too. But then there's the market. The market is truly global, and it's actually got real prices. This is something that I think, like, the incentives are real, the market is real, and the prices are real. And governments, since governments became a thing, have been trying to fight against market prices and failing indefinitely. They just always fail. You can't fight the market. All you can ever do is push it into the dark, or manipulate it and basically make it bloated until finally reality comes back and slaps you in the face and all the prices go back to what they were supposed to go to and everybody freaks out. Which is something that governments are pretty fond of doing too. Talking about pushing markets into the dark is Bitcoin's not afraid of the dark. Bitcoin was born there. The first 2 or 3 years of any semblance of a market in Bitcoin was for illegal crap. Bitcoin is like to ban Bitcoin is to just put it like right where it was always ready to be. Actually, Katie Hahn was a federal prosecutor back in 2012 during the whole Silk Road days, and she was actually assigned the task at the DOJ of. Literally, they're like, "Oh, we got this perfect assignment for you," because she was like kind of techie. And she's like, "We want you to figure out how to turn off Bitcoin," and she was like, "Okay," and she started investigating it, and she basically reached two conclusions. One, there's not really any way to do that. She was like, "Well, crap. It's basically like BitTorrent. Like, there's this huge distributed network. Like, what do you want me to do? I'm sorry." And the other was that the protocol itself is actually agnostic to what you use it for. Like, it doesn't really matter. Like, you don't have to be a criminal to use Bitcoin. It's like BitTorrent. It's what put BitTorrent in a legal gray area and made it incredibly difficult to attack, because you're basically trying to figure out how to define the illegality of just this really generic file distribution protocol. She likened it actually to saying, "Oh, we should just run out and prosecute all cash in the world." She's like, "It just doesn't make any sense." And oddly enough, she became a Bitcoin enthusiast, and she got on the board at Coinbase and became a general partner at Andreessen Horowitz, that $350 million cryptocurrency fund. So if that's what happens to everybody who's tasked with trying to kill Bitcoin, I guess we'll be fine. But at the heart of all of this. The most anti-fragile thing of all, if you will, is the desire for humans to live free and the power of the human mind to create and defend that freedom. That's what this is about. I can say that this is that's why we are here right now. Like, I'm so happy to actually be out doing stuff and talking to Bitcoiners. You are my people. So thank y'all for coming to this. So back to the hashing power real quick. One thing about the hash power, because this is something like a lot of people talk about, governments trying to like dominate or 51% attack the network. First off, I think about 25% of the network now runs over Tor network. So it doesn't actually have any like geographic location. And as far as the hash power goes, I've read an article recently that said Bitcoin now consumes as much energy as Switzerland. And it's funny, this article's talking about like how horrible this is, and we got to stop Bitcoin. I can't believe we're allowing it to use all this energy. And I'm like, getting
jacked reading this article, being like, how do we get it to the top of the list? And one of the things about that is, just think, when you're competing with a global market where people, like anyone, like governments suck at competing with markets. Markets are always, like the Soviet Union, we saw, like when they started to destroy the legacy market and when they started to put in price controls and capital controls, the black market simply became the more productive one. They pushed it into the dark, and then suddenly the black market was the only reason the Soviet Union still had an economy to speak of. We're seeing the same thing in Venezuela, we're seeing in Argentina, all the countries as capital controls get worse, as political unrest gets worse, the legitimate markets get pushed into the dark, and that is where Bitcoin thrives. And so if, let's say a government tries to dominate the hash power, this is where I think ASICs were the most important thing to happen for Bitcoin security, is that we have a mining industry that is 100% isolated to Bitcoin. Like, you can't do anything else with that chip. Like, we're talking about massive investments that have to be long-term thought out, and you can't use it for anything else. If you could actually use that chip for something else, that would be a terrible thing, because suddenly you could just cut your miner off. You don't have to secure the Bitcoin network with that investment. Oh, you could, hash for proteins or something like that, or you could use it for a medical experiment or whatever. Like, but you can't. You either just eat the cost or you secure Bitcoin. So they'd have to dump billions of dollars into the actual industry that they would be trying to fight with this hash rate attack. And, or of course, they, covertly try to manufacture their own chip that's better than everything on the market, and they produce millions and millions of these things in secret and then set up some massive freaking data center, and somehow we didn't know, and in the 2 years that it takes them to do this, like, we've doubled and tripled the hash power again, so their whole plan is crap. Let's say the NSA, the only people in government that can do IT anyway, actually tries to pull this off, and they do it in like their data center in Utah. To just to turn the machines on, they have to cut off all the power to Utah and Colorado. Like, that's how much force is behind this thing. And the beauty of mining is that it's literally creating an energy force field around the history of Bitcoin. Like, it's kind of Star Trek shit. Like, the hash wall is proof that the only way inside to change or manipulate the history of Bitcoin is with just an ungodly amount of power. So I just don't think that's very realistic, to be perfectly frank. And the fact that the market continues, and now we look to be on the cusp of another bull market, I think the ship has already sailed, but 6 months to a year, I think it's just going to be kind of a distant memory. So what about like a straight ban? Let's just say they just make it illegal. Incentives matter. The reason, like I say, like, governments suck at fighting market prices. Capital controls and runaway inflation are the very reason Bitcoin becomes obvious. That's what makes its value intuitive. A ban on Bitcoin necessitates the idea that our government is getting ridiculous about capital controls. And the only scenario in which the United States in particular really does, like, I think, flat out ban Bitcoin is if there's enormous amounts of capital flight from the country, or if there's runaway inflation, which is exactly when everybody has to stop and go, what's this Bitcoin thing again? And again, I'm sure everybody is familiar with the Streisand effect. Banning it publicly and being incredibly serious about doing so could very well draw more attention to it. And we actually kind of have an example of what it's like in that environment where people are scared of losing their money, is that, 1933, There's the executive order that, you know, you couldn't own gold anymore. What happened to the price of gold? It went up. Not down, it went up. And the people who could still get their hands on some privately rushed out to do so immediately. Unfortunately, Bitcoin doesn't have any like peer-to-peer markets or anything, but let's say the price does crash. This is something that like skeptics bring up a lot. I can't believe how many times it's like, oh, but the price would crash. And I'm like, oh my God. We don't know what that's like. You know how I know Bitcoin can survive a 50 to 60% crash? Because we've done it like 13 times. Like I said, we have real prices. It's a real market. When reality adjusts, Bitcoin adjusts, and that's its most important feature, is that it doesn't get bloated. It doesn't have systemic market risks. It's not gonna leverage itself 50 to one. It's only people in the legacy markets that are scared of a 2% move, and they go screaming to the government, please, Jesus, save us. Like, and then they cook the books for another couple of trillion dollars and make their situation worse. While Bitcoin's over here giving us real prices, and you know, Bitcoiners are like they're training like an army of market chads that when the price drops by 50%, you know, everybody's running scared and there's a collapse of faith in the legacy markets. And Bitcoiners are looking out in their driveway going like, do I really need two cars? Like, I could get 3K out of that, out of the crappier one. And that's like half a Bitcoin for, you know, maybe a day or two. So I don't think there's any stopping the market. And, you know, the realistic, like, I think the framing is also wrong, is that it's not really so much that a country can ban Bitcoin. I think it's more the obvious, more the opposite, is that a country really only has the power to ban itself from Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the new global market, and they either get to play the game or they're gonna watch as technology leaves them behind. But at the end of the day, the last line of defense for Bitcoin is its people. This is made up of people who run nodes. Every time I find out there's a new way to kill or hurt Bitcoin or possibly censor something or bifurcate the network, it's from a Bitcoiner. Nobody works as hard as we do in trying to figure out how to kill the thing so that we can make it unkillable. And this was never about asking permission. Like, so the cypherpunks, oh, I'm a little low on time. Oh, I love that story. I'll have to skip over that one. But at the end of the day, this is about freedom, right? As I said earlier, I was talking about like the assumption that that the governments would ban Bitcoin. That's kind of like the skeptics' next first point after figuring out that that can actually work as money. There was a recognition that means Bitcoin can work as money, but there's actually a more sinister presumption of the statement that, oh, well, Bitcoin governments will just ban it. And even the most flag-waving American could tell you that and not realize that that means they really don't think we live in a free country. That the default assumption is just like, well, government's gonna ban it. Well, so you're saying that a technology that works, that can actually better people's lives, that has an unbelievable potential for novel applications, would be banned by the government not in spite of that, but specifically because of it. Like, that's not a world I want to live in. You know, if Bitcoin, this last line in the Declaration of Independence says, in support of this declaration, we mutually pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And when I look around in Bitcoin, when I talk to the people who like really get this, that's what I see. Like, And we didn't like just like platitude, like, oh yeah, yeah, I'll sell my house in case something goes wrong. Like, we already staked all our fortunes on this thing. Like, we actually did. And if there's even a 1% chance that this thing can work, it's like, why the hell are we wasting our time with the other 99%? Because we have the potential to actually get privacy, freedom, and sovereignty back in the digital age. And if we actually end up in a future where we're in like some Orwellian panopticon surveillance state, social credit score crap, I don't want to have to look back like and tell my grandkids that there was a potential that we could actually have gotten our freedom, gotten our privacy back, and I didn't try because like I thought the government might have told me I shouldn't do it. Like, I'm not gonna have to say that to anybody. I'm all in, motherfuckers. Five-minute questions? Okay. All right, couple minutes for questions. Who wants to go? Who's starting? Do what? Okay. Yeah, there's a mic by the cameras over there. So if y'all want to go up there and ask some questions. Okay, I'll tell the quick version. Back in the 1990s, the federal government listed basic cryptography schemes as a military munition, as a weapon of war. And in doing so, they actually made it a federal crime to export it, to take it across borders. This is just information. This is just lines of code. We're now a literal federal law, a crime punishable by decades in prison. Now, the cypherpunks and cryptographer, like the cypherpunk mailing list was already around. Now, did they just be like, throw up their hands like, oh, well, crap, that sucks. They had him back, actually, was part of this. And he printed it on a t-shirt and started selling it. They started using, he wrote three lines of Perl code, and everybody started using it as a signature at the bottom of their email, so that every single time they sent out like a new thing on the mailing list, they were breaking federal law. And then there was a guy, one of the guys named Vincent Kate, actually started up a website that had across the banner across the top of the website said become an international arms trafficker in one click. And there was just a button, and it would send PGP code from a US server to one in Anguilla. And then, so it's like we're boasting and we're making it as simple as possible to break a federal law. And then they had a public board where you could sign your name and brag about it. You know, that's insane. Like, cypherpunks were never asking permission. They looked at an unjust, immoral, stupid law, and it was a badge of honor to go up and break it and say, come at me, bro, put me in prison. And it was, they actually fought like a decades-long legal battle suing the government over it, and like the EFF, they were all donating to it, make sure to keep it alive. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, a bunch of other company or institutions like that. And they actually won in late, like, 99 or 2000 or something like that. And you'd think they'd stop there, but they actually, Bernstein, the guy who actually led it, turned right around and sued him again for something else. So cypherpunks are not one to take anything lying down. So it's good to have them on our side. Sorry, question.
Reading. It's much appreciated.
Thank you guys for all the articles.
You must have a long list of things yet to read. What's on your list that you keep setting aside because you're afraid the audience is too technical or small?
There's a lot of great stuff that has like charts and stuff. There's like a lot of research reports. There's one from Fidelity. There's one on like central banking inequality, and I have a hard time like putting those on just because I fight about like whether or not I should like describe the charts, like it's going up and to the right. It's a little difficult when they lean heavily on like visuals and data, because it doesn't come across very well in audio. But If I can get to it, I usually just eventually get to it. I'll just have a day where I don't exactly know what to do, and I'll be like, you know, it's time to do that central banking thing. But none right now, actually. I'm just waiting to get back to my mic so I can hit Parker Lewis's Bitcoin is One for All.
Hey, guy, just a quick comment and just a thought. So you said something earlier that I used to wholeheartedly believe as well, but I've really come to question it.
Okay.
Which is, you said people desire freedom. And I'm just curious about you rethinking that, or I rethought that in this sort of latest environment we had. I watched people who I thought loved freedom demand freedoms be taken away, when there were obvious other options to everybody's freedoms being taken away. I'm just curious your thoughts on that. It's one thing that sort of scared me, that there obviously are people that do love freedom, but is it really widespread enough to make sure we secure what we're trying to create here?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I don't think people desire freedom philosophically. People don't understand it philosophically. And granted, Bitcoin has pushed a lot of people who I think were on the other side of the fence over it and actually deeply curious about it. But people are afraid. You know, when people get scared, they want to feel safe. But you got to remember, though, that's a desire to get freedom for themselves. Like, what they're trying to do is make their life safe. They're trying to make their situation and their freedom secure. It's just that the political system puts them at odds with everybody else. So that to get their freedom, to get their comfort, they have to put something on your face. And this is basically how things have always gone. But at the end of the day, Bitcoin is a system where the self-interested actually enhance the power and the freedom of those around them. That they aren't at odds when you use Bitcoin or when you use a system that basically forces a degree of honesty and cooperation, that any player who's cheating or diverting from the social contract, for lack of a better word, is basically just evicted from things. So they no longer get the benefits of their own freedom. So their self-interest drives what gives freedom to everyone else. I think, yeah, there is always that kind of risk, but I think that's the reverse incentives of the political system that make that have such terrible outcomes. But at the end of the day, people are going to be afraid of the failing financial system and of the systemic risk and the political instability, and they're going to be running to freedom, and Bitcoin is going to be there one way or the other. So, all right, wrapped up. All right, cool. Thank you, guys. BitBlock
Boom! Thank you for listening to the BitBlock Boom podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and share the podcast with your friends. Make sure and take a look at this year's lineup of speakers at bitblockboom.com. And if you use the code COUSINS, that's COUSINS, when purchasing your conference tickets, you'll receive 30% off the price of a general admission ticket. I hope to meet you at next year's BitBlock Boom Conference in Dallas, Texas, and thanks for listening. BitBlock Boom!